Accession number 24193, reel 5.
Mr. Towell, reel 5. I'd like now to. We were talking about when you were with the 1st Battalion Royal Norfolk Regiment at Hubbelrath, near Dusseldorf, from mid 1950. I want Dan to look at your real job, so to speak, you know, the bread and butter of being a platoon commander.
Yes.
You were in D Company, you think, but not too sure of the platoon number. How did you set about taking command of your platoon and sort of, establishing yourself as their officer?
Yes, I think it was the going into a company was the real meat of the job. These other jobs of equitation offer and so on, I think, were to make sure that you didn't stand around on street corners. I think the role there was one of, in D Company, was of training. And here you make the transition from a Sandhurst, where, as I think all of us felt, we could command a division more easily than a platoon. One went straight into handling the affairs of 25 to 30 men, rather dependent upon the sergeant, who was the avenue of communication with the soldiers. And of course, you were a little apprehensive, being your first real job from Sandhurst. And it was so dependent upon the sergeant, the way he handled you, the way you reacted to him, and of course how you did your training. I think the first role really was creating a training program, and you did one a month in advance.
So what would that be? I mean,
it would be basically weapon handling, the Bren gun, the rifle, the Sten, hand grenades, the throwing thereof, the mechanism, the I think even Piat, the projectile infantry anti-tank, was still around, although it had such a bad reputation in the war, none of us took that seriously. But weapon handling, stripping down, understanding, firing those weapons was very important. Drill for the building of teamwork was very important. I think the development of leadership, both of the corporals, a platoon at that time, and still is probably, it consists of three sections and a little platoon headquarters. A section is headed by a corporal on full establishment, with a lance corporal as his number two, and about eight men, three of those, and a sergeant, and an officer, and generally speaking, a wireless operator, and maybe one other. That was the core of the platoon, and indeed the core of the company and of the and of the battalion. So training was weaponry, was tactics in field training, both at the platoon level and the company level and the battalion level. It was a life of much of a brigade exercises. We were in four guards brigade. Hence, the guards are usually smart, and we tended to try and be smarter than them, which was difficult. We would do field exercises of many sorts, but often going to forests in Germany and training at Sennelager, I remember, great training grounds used by the German army. And we would have exercises.
What would they be like? Perhaps a typical one.
A typical one would be you go away for a week into a big, either open prairie-like land, heath land, or you'd be in forest, and you'd be either the enemy attacking, or you'd be a defender. And there would be roles against other members of the brigade. We would be the enemy, they would be the defender, and so on. And so one would have these exercises, which at our bottom level, the platoon, really amounted to lots of waiting, and then feverish activity and lots of waiting. We dug so many slit trenches and filled them in almost automatically on having dug them in training. And umpires would come round and award us points for our positioning. Sometimes we'd use real blanks, and there'd be a lot of activity. They were always rather exciting, and corporals, section commanders, had an opportunity of moving men. You had an opportunity of moving your sections around, maintaining wireless communication, which was always a terrible problem, because even in 1950 we found our wireless sets were really rather poor. The 88 set and the 31 set, which was the company commander level. We also did in other trainings. Oh, we would always try and scrounge food from German houses, which I remember. And one learnt one's basic sort of German, like Brunt Kartoffel is zwei Eier bitte, you know, which is could we have some fried potato and eggs, and we'd give you cigarettes or coffee. And the relationship between the German farming community and ourselves was very good. We were always very particular not to spoil the land after exercises, filling in, as I mentioned, these slit trenches.
How about the German civilians generally, you know, in the towns, the villages, everywhere, you know? Was only 5 years after the war?
Yes, yes. There were several points there. Firstly, if going into town, and as young men we'd like to go into town, however, like Dusseldorf, however, we had to wear uniform. And in the evening, this would be number one dress, which was blues. And you were very obviously, it was obvious who you were, so you'd try and go into a nightclub or a bar and relax and pick up a few girls to talk to. But it was very obvious who you were. And at that time, there was a lot of tenseness in Germany. Audenau was the president, Konrad Audenau, I think his name was. And in Dusseldorf, there were a lot of communist cells, and we were constantly, seriously now, as opposed to training, being called out in aid of the civil power.
So what would that be like?
That was quite active, in the sense that we would be warned for control, traffic, crowd control, and generally at 24 hours and 12 hours notice, and then I think it was 6 hours notice to get into our trucks, go down to Dusseldorf. We carried barbed wire, we carried rifles and live ammunition, and would often set up concertinaed barbed wire to block off roads when there were fairly massive demonstrations, generally communist against the civil authorities, which were rather weak, i.e. the police, and with notices saying in German, we'd have placards saying, if you cross this line, we will fire. We had several altercations. We did not ever fire in anger, but we fired over the heads of crowds, which is not generally approved, because the army always says that you only ever fire to create damage. You don't fire warning shots. However, the mayor on this occasion asked us to fire over the heads to frighten people into scattering, which they did. I remember I and a small detachment went down one tiny lane to head off a group, and we got surrounded by a rather larger group of Germans with a very large Alsatian, and I've been terrified of Alsatians ever since. And this one leapt at me, knocked me to the ground, and bit me in the buttocks. So much so, and wouldn't let go, that the sergeant got his Sten gun and shot the dog. And that was quite dramatic. And we were probably in 6 months called out about four times, generally on classical calendar events. Or some political event was going to happen. We didn't enjoy it. We didn't know how long they were going to last. And it was a bit frightening. But the rules were very clear. You didn't fire at all unless you got an instruction from the civil authority and, of course, your senior officer. But so often we were split up into little detachments and had to go down a side road, close that side road, and that's where the difficulties happened. So we did that quite a lot. It was a very unsettled time in Germany, in the big urban areas. And thereafter, I think, we went back to exercises, drilling competition, again with the guards.
How important was competition? I mean, you hear quite a lot that the British Army was almost built on a competitive culture. Can you talk about, I mean, how important was it to you that your platoon was the best in the company?
Terribly important in just about everything from sport, within the regiment, within the company. We had to really try and win football matches, water polo, hockey, heaven knows what, within the company, i.e. between the three platoons, within the battalion, i.e. the four companies and the two support companies, within the brigade and within the division. And in fact, even going back to riding, I'd have to ride for the brigade in hunter trials and point to points and be marked accordingly. And so that was not only sport, it was points in training, there'd be drill competitions, there'd be boxing, inter-regimental boxing competitions. I think this largely kept us on our toes if we just thought we were doing too much sedentary barrack room, barracks stuff. Competition was, I think, the common theme throughout our military life.
Do you think it raised standards?
Yes, I think it did. Oh, absolutely. Without it, there wasn't much incentive, except your commanding officer telling you off if you had lowered standards. But I think the men shared in this excitement. And don't forget, there were a lot of National Service people, rather well-educated people, often. They had to be stimulated. Otherwise, it would have degenerated into a political sort of, well, why are we here? We're only here for 18 months or 2 years or whatever it is. We don't need to do all this stuff. And they rather enjoyed the challenge. They rather enjoyed the ability, the opportunity to be better than the next unit.
Can I ask about National Servicemen, how you brought it up? But, I mean, did they stand out? Could you tell a National Serviceman from a regular?
All the time, I think.
In what way?
The regular, generally speaking, was older, of course, and you could identify it from that. The regular was either a corporal or above, very rarely a private soldier, unless he was a demoted corporal or sergeant for being a bit naughty in the evening and drinking too much and so on. The National Service men debated. We had current affairs discussions as to, well, what's going on, the Berlin airlift and all those sort of types that came later, of course, I think. I can't remember if it was before. But those national issues of the day, what was National Service all about? We would have quite serious debates, to the alarm often of the regulars, because the National Servicemen would say, well, I don't think that's right, sir. You know, I think you've got it wrong. And, of course, the sergeant would begin to bristle. And I loved it. I thought it was very important to get the soldiers, as we then, you know, as they were generally called, the opportunity to airing issues. And, of course, it came out in Korea later as a very serious issue. So National Servicemen were excellent. They were better educated. They were professional people in some cases. And they shone. They absolutely shone. And at the end of the day, if you now talk to those men, as I see them in regimental occasions, dinners and so on, they went back and they became very successful, in most cases, businessmen, leaders, church, whatever, whatever. And they always refer back to their time of National Service with great affection. I do know that they'd say, sir, I couldn't have done this if I hadn't been in the army. And I'd had that discipline, and I had that team spirit, games, competition, building on team spirit. And they felt, and they belonged to a unit, and I thought that was so important. It's hard in civilian life to belong to anything except your own family and maybe your company when you're working there. But there are many periods in the desert between those items.
Now, how important was establishing a good relationship with your platoon sergeant? Because there were you're a second lieutenant of under 20 probably, and you're dealing with someone who could be middle-aged, necessarily, but they could be. How did you... I don't know whether you remember who yours was, but at that time, but how important was it?
I think it was very, very important indeed. And some of us young officers got it right, some of us got it wrong. if you tried to boss the scene and give orders based on the extent of your experience, which might only be a month or two within the regiment, you were quickly going to get into serious trouble.
In what way?
And by giving the wrong orders, not being sensitive to interpersonal skills within the company and in the platoon, and relationships would deteriorate, and the sergeant would either help you dig yourself out of the holes you were digging for yourself. Most would. Some, I think, would be remarkably cheesed off with it, maybe a bit pissed off, and would probably say, well, let him get on with it. And as John Denny always used to say, we'd give these young officers enough rope but wouldn't let them hang themselves. I thought it was a lovely, lovely expression. But it was terribly important. And one became more sensitive to this as your time went on. One was 2 years as a second lieutenant and 2 years, I think, as a lieutenant.
Now, all that time, how should you behave with your platoon sergeant then? I mean, what was the best role to...
I think you took advice and you listened. And it did not in any way weaken your image. Quite the contrary. One would say, I think, in an exercise, if you said, well, I think we'll go this way, so Sergeant so-and-so, why don't you take two sections around that way? And a good sergeant will say, excuse me, sir, I think if we look at the alternative, and maybe on the left there's a bit more cover and dead ground and so on, and you would say, well, yes, fine, okay. Or you would say, no, no, I want you to go that way, and you get it wrong. He was right, almost invariably. I think an excellent sergeant would be sensitive to these issues and would handle you. I think there is an expression, you get the manager you deserve. You handle your up the line of seniority. The sergeant would handle you and get the best out of you, and you knew that you were being handled. And what you should do is listen, follow advice, ask advice, and that gave you more confidence. And it was more of, and it sounds strange in the army, it was more of a concerted decision. There was a sense of unanimity there, that we all agree that this is the best way to go. In administration of the soldiers, the sergeant was absolutely... critical. He would know that Charlie Brown, who's up on a charge, always does this thing. He doesn't really mean it. It isn't serious. What I suggest you do, sir, is you be lenient with him in any punishment. So you would be guided by a good sergeant, and it could make or break the success of the platoon. Some of our officers wouldn't recognize that and would come with their pip on their shoulder. And to a degree, perhaps some form of inferiority, it sounds odd, inferiority chip on their shoulder, feeling they should make all the decisions, everybody should obey them. I think, not claiming any great success here, but I felt I needed advice. I took it, I asked it for it, and found that it worked well. It didn't mean that the sergeant was always right, but you agreed to differ, but you were elegantly respectful of the individual. If you respected individuals, I found in the army, rank, then you got the best out of people. I thought it was absolutely critical that if a private soldier had something to say, you listened, and you were seen to be listening and taking it on board, and it may influence the course of the decision, and you get a better overall decision. People feel involved, and one could count on the platoon backing you. Whereas you just said, right, get over that trench and jump there and lay down and do that, people would do it, but there'd only be a performance up to an average level.
A bit more about how you got on with the actual, you know, the privates, you know, the other ranks. So you tried to at least give them the illusion that they were being listened to, and probably really did listen to them. But would you actually get to know them as individuals? Did you learn their names? And
it was very difficult. I was very bad at names. I think most people in Britain are. I've since learned, having had 20 years in America, to ask people to spell their name, and you listen and you learn. It was very hard to get to know the men, except through sporting activity. And you always knew that Private John Higgins was an excellent footballer as goalkeeper, and that would figure something in your mind when you would see him, and you would say, well, have you saved any goals recently? And he would laugh at a feeble little joke like that. But you sort of meant it, because you were trying to bridge. You would have a social intercourse with them at Christmas times, and there'd be a regiment, there'd be a platoon party, which the sergeant would have suggested, and you would meet in the naffy, and generally speaking, the officer would make a significant contribution to the evening, and people would drink a lot of beer and sing songs.
Did you maintain the formalities in the sense of, they'd call you sir, and you'd call them Private Higgins or whatever, on social occasions, would it come out even to first names? Or I doubt that. But
No, absolutely not. In my total experience, it was always Sergeant George, or Corporal Higgins, or Private Smith. And you were proud if you could remember Private Smith. You had 30 people, you were supposed to know all about them, but it was very difficult. The sergeant knew everything about the individuals. He knew their health. One would have health inspections and so on, which you were supposed to go down and give them Paladrine, where, if you were in the right place, a Paladrine. Or you'd sometimes have these rather indecent inspections, what were called short-arm inspections, to see whether they had any form of VD or so on.
What inspections?
For venereal disease.
No, but did they do foot inspections as
Yes, I'd forgotten that. They were terribly important, of course, because infantry marches on its feet. And they were very important and done, I think, regularly, like weekly. And the officer had to sign a book that he'd personally inspected every soldier's in his command, every soldier's feet.
Did you, or did you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Pass it on to the sergeant.
The sergeant would be there and almost make sure that the officer signed the book.
Can I ask if there was a welfare or pastoral role as a junior officer? Censoring letters doesn't really come into it in Germany, but in actual sort of providing a point where if there was problems at home, I mean, they were in Germany and, things go wrong at home. Was there that sort of welfare role?
It was a formal welfare role. If a soldier needed leave because there'd been a problem at home, then he would ask to see the officer. The sergeant would arrange it and he would come to the platoon office and would be marched in. It was a formal occasion and the sergeant was present. And he would then explain to us, the sergeant and the officer, that he had to go home. He's heard his wife was having problems, or his mother, or sickness, or something of that sort. But other than that, there was no pastoral role of knowing about the families. In wartime, it became a lot of this formality, of course, didn't exist. You can't sort of salute and stamp your feet in a slit trench.
We'll come to those changing sort of things. Perhaps if we look at some of the key people in first the company and then sort of the regiment, you may not remember. I've got a list of what they were when they went to Korea, which they can't have changed that much. I wonder, was the D Company your major? Was that Davis, Major Davis?
No, he did not. That was Major Davis in Germany, but an awful lot of the officers changed when we went to Dover.
Perhaps then we'll come back to that. Do you remember any particular officers?
Tim Creasy, obviously the adjutant. I don't remember the colonel very well.
Do you remember much about, tell us a bit more about Tim Creasy. What kind of, we came in very senior, didn't he? What kind of a man was he then as a relatively, I presume, a major or a captain?
He was a captain. He was adjutant of the regiment, the colonel's right-hand man, and he ruled the battalion on behalf of the colonel, and he ruled the officers. You always went to see the adjutant first about if you had affairs, problems, if you had issues, if your performance was above or below par, he would be the disciplinarian, he would be the giver of tidings, good or bad. He would make the postings. Taola, you've got to take a detachment of men and be on guard duty down at the Treasury in Dusseldorf. You would receive those sort of orders, or you're on guard duty at the brigade headquarters next week for 48 hours. Make sure you've got a good turnout, and I will probably inspect you before you go. So it was a form of centralized discipline. Tim Creasy was a frightening man to observe, but
in what way?
Because he was big, he had a moustache, he was gruff. There was no small talk at all. Once you got to know him, you could get a smile, just, and you would have the temerity to smile back. That probably wasn't encouraged. But he was very firm in his orders, very clear, crystal clear, and understood the problem before you'd finished telling it to him. I liked him very much indeed, and I saw him later in life outside the army. He became, obviously, head of the British Army, General Sir Tim Creasy. And there were others there, Major Hubert Holden.
What was he like?
He was a super. He was a landowner, if you can understand the terminology here. I mean, he was a landowner in Norfolk. He was used to handling an estate with lots of workers. He knew about people. He was a people person. And just very soft, very gentle, but very clear, and a very nice man indeed. He was my company commander in Korea, ultimately.
Did you change companies?
Yes, I did.
To see?
Yes, because I went through a small staff job and then into a company. One tended not to stay at that early age. Second lieutenants were like sort of milk bottle tops. They were moved around a great deal, and often to give them experience, both of different commanders and of different groups of men.
Now, what about the other company commanders? Was Davis actually a company commander?
Yes, yes, he was.
What was he like? I don't know his first name. P.N. Davis, it says.
Peter Davis.
What was he like?
He was very good to us second lieutenants. Very good indeed. He was helpful, constructive, didn't give you anything too difficult, and just said, keep up with the training and let me see your training programs. And every week we would have a meeting, an orders group, an O group. And I think a very constructive person. But at that time, you know, that 6 months, my first 6 months, a lot of it was spent out of the company control, out of the regimental control, because you were on assignments, these guards. Sometimes you were sent off on exercises by yourself, but with another regiment's company. And then I would do my officer mess and my equitation. And the sergeant, in my absence, would run the platoon as though there would be no difference, and probably ran it a jolly sight better. People such as Brian Imsden was a lieutenant then, became senior, and Frank Fleming and Fitzgerald were all senior lieutenants to me, all played roles in the future with me, and often gave guidance, friendly guidance, you know, how you behaved at the mess. And you tended to attach yourself to one of these senior lieutenants. I attached myself to Brian Emsden, who became signals officer and a rather senior, a brigadier ultimately.
What was he like then, as a young lieutenant?
Oh, young, bright, seemingly to me clever.